Thanks for listening to the Best of Herd Podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday from 12 to 3 Eastern, 9 to noon Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and FS1. Find your local station for the Herd at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every day on the iHeartRadio app by searching Herd.
This is the Best of the Herd with Colin Cowherd on Fox Sports Radio.
Ah, here we go on a Tuesday live in Los Angeles. This is The Herd. Wherever you may be and however you may be listening, iHeartRadio, Fox Sports Radio, FS1 and Sirius XM Channel 83, the former Miami Dolphin, Pro Bowler Brian Cox, 1 hour from now, Jets, Bears, Pates, Pats, and Dolphins. They'll be joining us. Joy Taylor, how are you?
I'm great. You know what I watched yesterday? The Alex Smith documentary.
How was that?
It's pretty fascinating. It's kind of hard not to root for him after watching it. And his leg, if you have a light stomach, it's not for you.
Yeah, I have not watched the injury. I've saw Joe Theismann's live once. I never watched it again. I hate watching athletes get hurt severely. It just
I do too. I never rewatch.
I can't.
But the comeback for him is really, I mean, he's had 17 surgeries. It's incredible.
So is the Michael Jordan documentary. I want to lead with this morning. Everybody's enjoying it except for, you know, the media, where some media people have taken shots at it. The latest is Mike Sielski, who writes for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Big column yesterday, which a lot of sports writers said, hear, hear. You are so accurate. Sports writers know more than everyone, and I'm glad you're unveiling the truth. Good boy. The headline here is The Last Dance. Michael Jordan shows us who he really is. Yeah, it's a documentary. It's not a movie. It's not fiction. Michael is showing us who he is, which is awesome and competitive and relentless and feisty as hell. And sometimes he can be a little mean. Scary. So are hedge fund guys. So are politicians. So, mean happens all the time. In his opening paragraph, it says, it's become harder to separate the entertainment and nostalgic value of the series from Jordan's agenda. Not really, not for anybody. 6 million people watch every week and everybody loves it. From his desire to preserve his legacy, imagine that, settle scores and rub his status and greatness in the faces of his real and perceived rivals. One in particular, Jerry Krause, the Bulls GM for 18 years. Has served a convenient function throughout The Last Dance. He's been the series' primary source of narrative tension. Yeah. Because the overwhelming story of The Last Dance is the tension. That's why it's called The Last Dance. You do get the entire series is about this season. And they go back and pluck different you know, dramas and controversies throughout the course of Michael's greatness. But it's called The Last Dance. And it's called The Last Dance because the Jerry Krause GM here who you're defending, who has passed away, rest in peace, told Phil Jackson, 82-0, I'm not bringing you back to break up the greatest dynasty ever. The entire documentary is called The Last Dance, which is what Phil wrote on a binder and gave to the team before the season because he told him, I'm not coming back. Let's call this The Last Dance. So, yes, the tension that Jerry Krause created is the title of the documentary. That's why there is narrative tension centered around Jerry Krause. That's what the story's about. So that's what they keep talking about. And Jerry created that. By the way, the writer also says there is something cheap and unseemly and quite telling about the inclination to continue bullying a man who isn't around to defend himself. No, Michael was tough on Jerry Krause when he lived. So why should he be inauthentic and lie? Sports writers are looking, some of them, for soft, happy endings to this. Or a new Michael. Michael has been completely authentic. He hates Isaiah. Did then, does now. Doesn't back away from it. Michael Jordan, business first over politics, then and now. Doesn't back away from it. Michael Jordan, gambled then and now. Doesn't back away from it. Critiques of Jerry Krause, ripped him then, rips him now. Sorry, this is not a movie. where the great villain learns about himself. And by the end of the movie, he's a better person. That's called a movie. This is a documentary. Documentaries are supposed to be real and authentic looks at the primary story. Jerry Krause was going to blow up the best team ever. Now, it may have been Jerry Reinsdorf, as Charles Barkley said yesterday. Very may well have been Reinsdorf's mission to be cheap. But Jerry Krause was such a insecure, as this writer does point out later in his article, Jerry was insecure. He was a kid that got picked on. He could never get over it. Steve Kerr acknowledged during this, and Steve Kerr's a nice guy. He's like, I was there. Jerry Krause couldn't get out of his own way. So when I read these articles about this is unveiling a new Michael, no, it's not. It's delivering the exact Michael. Everything I thought about Michael before, I think about him now. I think he's relentless. I think he's great. I think he's incredibly competitive. He's intense. He's an alpha male. And if he didn't like you, he'd confront you. He didn't back away from Isaiah. He didn't back away from Jerry Krause. He wasn't passive aggressive. He didn't have a burner phone. He'd go right after you. And that's why we love him. So this is not a movie. The Americas made their mind up. They like Michael more than an insecure general manager who may have been, in his private life, a wonderful guy. But there were so many missteps by Jerry Krause telling Phil Jackson, 82-0, you're not back. Can you imagine if Bob Myers had told Steve Kerr that going into year before's win for the Warriors? Let's not make Jerry Krause a victim here. Everybody in this documentary has come out just like we thought. Now, I do think Phil Jackson, who I had a great deal of respect for, I've got even more for him now. I'm like, there's so many spinning plates. I always thought Phil was the best coach in the NBA I'd ever seen. Now, he's the best psychologist in America and the best coach. So I do think I all this stuff with Phil, I've kind of been blown away by his balancing act of Rodman and Krause and Reinsdorf and Pippen, and it's his maturity and his emotional discipline has blown me away. Everybody else is landing exactly as I thought. In fact, I didn't ever cover the Bulls directly. I wish I would have. I know people that did, and I've had people on that did, but I didn't cover them directly. But you didn't have to be a Bulls insider to know Jerry Krause and Jerry Reinsdorf were not ideal, that Michael and Pippen and Phil were often working against them. And that's been portrayed. That's not bullying. That's not cheap. I mean, if I struggled with somebody my entire life in my career, thank God I haven't. But if they do a documentary someday, and it will be low budget if they did on my career, I would tell you exactly what I felt then and now. I wouldn't soft pedal it. If I didn't like somebody, there's a couple sportscasters I don't like. I don't like them now, and I'd tell you later, yeah, I didn't like them. That would be. Now, if you gave the script to Hollywood, they'd have a happy ending. But that's not what we're doing here. I think it's been a great documentary. I think sometimes when they go back in time with the dates, it's a little confusing for me as a viewer. I think some of that is Jason Hare, the documentarian, who I had in my podcast last week. The guy is rushed. They literally started this thing, airing it, and they weren't finished. They're still editing it. I mean, they're not done with this thing. It's a rush job. It is. They don't get nearly as much time. You don't want to start a documentary. Start airing it and you haven't finished it. That's just not the way it works, right? You want it done, you get production finished. But this idea that we're all struggling with how brutal and ruthless Mike is. I don't think anybody I know is struggling with it. I think it is absolutely, I think I respect Michael more because he's not a BSer. And maybe we're softer in society. Maybe we're all more evolved now and we should be nicer. But it's funny. Fans say, and the numbers illustrate, people used to like the NBA more in Michael Jordan's era. It was tougher. The players were older. They were veterans. And research shows people liked him, and people still buy more Michael shoes than LeBron, Steph, Kevin Durant shoes combined. But part of that, like, I don't think the media really quite gets, we like the alpha. Like, I love the fact that Michael won't back down from his gambling, his Isaiah hate, his Republicans buy sneakers too, and calling out the management. That's part of what I like. I'm not struggling at all with it. It makes me like him more. Because I for years and years, people said, you're an MJ hater. And I'm like, no, but he's not perfect. This is what I said on the air for years. I know a lot of guys that covered Michael. He's not perfect. And you know what we're seeing during this documentary? He's not perfect. He's real. Michael is real. You know what? He can be a real pain in the butt. He can be real vindictive. He can be real petty. He can sometimes be real mean. But he's real. And I'll take that every day of the week instead of the social media posturing I see from everybody else.
Want more Herd? The Herd streams 24 hours a day, 7 days a week within the iHeartRadio app. Search Herd to listen live or on demand whenever you'd like.
If you're a critic of OBJ, and in New York, the media was critical of him. They thought he was into OBJ more than winning. I think he's really talented. Sometimes I think he's high maintenance. I'm not a huge fan of high maintenance people. So I have kind of a confirmation bias against anybody that I think is needy. They just wear me out. Cam Newton wears me out. I probably never gave him a fair shot, but OBJ sometimes, same thing. So yesterday he comes out, talks about his body, how it got beaten down last year, and he has struggled with injuries. You know, he's a guy that'll run routes over the middle. He gets clobbered. He gets hurt. He's been injured. It's part of a real story, a real narrative now about him. But he says, this now is my time. This is probably going to be one of my best seasons. I'm bigger, stronger. This is my time. And my first thought is, okay, the critics of OBJ are going to say, oh, it's always your time. It's not our time. It's not us. It's not we. It's not team. It's I, me. Look at my Bentley. Look at my watches. And even his quote now, it's my time. It's actually not. It's Kevin Stefanski's time. It's his time to put in a new system. There's two things here that need to be considered and discussed with OBJ saying it's his time. Number one, Cleveland has, in my opinion, the deepest arsenal outside of maybe the Kansas City Chiefs offensively in the NFL. They got two of everything. So if OBJ thinks he's going to have 95 catches and a dozen touchdowns, he's delusional. He's not going to get those touches. Number two is Kevin Stefanski likes to run the football. Kirk Cousins was 24th in pass attempts. That's with Adam Thielen and Stephon Diggs. Cleveland also has two excellent running backs. Kevin Stefanski's also in a division with Baltimore and Pittsburgh's pass rush. He's not going to put Baker Mayfield in the crosshairs 34 times on pass attempts. Cleveland's building a run-first offense. Here's something else. Cleveland brought in an excellent tight end, Austin Hooper from Atlanta. Last year in 13 games, he had 75 catches. Okay, he's an 80 to 85 catch potential tight end. He's a volume tight end. Jarvis Landry, even in the mayhem last year in Cleveland, had like 80, 85 catches. In Miami, it was 90. We suspect he'll get closer to his career average, 90. So Austin Hooper's going to get 75 to 80. Landry's going to get, you know, 85 to 90, 95. And they've got two excellent running backs and a new coach who likes to run the football. If OBJ thinks he's getting a bunch of touches and a bunch of touchdowns, he's off. And happiness is all about expectations. The data tells you this coach runs the football. Austin Hooper is going to be a sponge in the middle of that defense. This is a new offense. And also, I would say this, Cleveland's going to be better. They're not going to be trailing in all their games like last year. If you look at Cleveland's schedule, there's a lot of wins on that schedule. They're not going to be throwing the ball in the fourth quarter in a lot of games. I think Cleveland's going to be a 9-win football team this year. Maybe 10, 9. I think it's a real football team. Just less chaos. But if you lead late in games, Kevin Stefanski is not going to be dropping Baker Mayfield back to pass. So happiness is about expectations, and OBJ may think it's his time, but I think it's Kevin Stefanski's time. And frankly, if you ask me who else's time it was, I'd say Baker Mayfield. He's going to win the coach's approval, or he's gone. And he's not going to win it throwing to OBJ. He's going to win it winning games. And you're going to win games in this league if you have a running game. You got to have some semblance of a running game. This was the first year New England couldn't run the football. It was their worst year in years.
Be sure to catch live editions of The Herd weekdays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio, FS1, and the iHeartRadio app.
Director of Sports Journalism at the prestigious Northwestern Medill School of Journalism, Jay Adonde, has the rare distinction of covering Michael Jordan for the Chicago Sun-Times and then the late Kobe Bryant for the Los Angeles Times. And I believe he's the only sports writer in America who ever had that distinction. There was a lot of national reporters or columnists who could, you know, on an individual game cover them. But it's a very unique situation. He's joining us now, sponsored by Mercedes-Benz, the best or nothing. So let's start, first of all, Jay. Thank you for coming on. Let's start with Michael. And so I imagine, as you watch this documentary, it is to some degree some confirmation of stuff you already kind of knew, right?
It is. It hasn't been revelatory for me. First of all, nice to be on with you, Colin. It hasn't been revelatory for me, or for, I think, any of the people that you see quoted in there or who had been around. But what it is for everyone else to get a chance to see it. And the one thing I do appreciate is hearing Michael discuss it with the benefit of perspective and, you know, hearing him look back and just seeing how unwilling he is to let certain things go, in particular the grudge with Isaiah Thomas. But you see what resonates with him. You see what sticks with him. But I think it's a chance for other people to see. It's funny, some of these stories that he's telling, in particular the time he went to go to retrieve Dennis Rodman when Rodman was AWOL. I had heard those stories before. I think it's fun that now it's out, it's being discussed publicly, we can all share in these stories.
You know, I defend him on the gambling issue. I said, listen, me gambling $100 is Michael gambling $50,000 on a golf game. He is a relentless competitive guy. And, you know, it shows him with security guards, you know, flipping quarters up against the wall. He didn't hide from it. That's who he is. He let himself be mic'd when he golfed, mic'd when he was flipping coins up against the wall. You know, the gambling issues, again, that was pretty much understood. Do you think he addressed those appropriately?
I think so. It's weird. He doesn't come off as super convincing. I believe him, but just his tone when he's defending himself against certain things is weird. And maybe it's in part because he's not in practice of having to defend himself. You know, he wasn't in that position a lot throughout his career. You know, all the exalted Michael Jordan. He didn't have to be defensive, and so he comes off as a little defensive here. One of the rare times that he's being asked to do so. But you got at it. The desire that he has anyone been as driven by money as Michael Jordan? The drive that he had to become the most marketed athlete in the world, certainly the most marketed athlete in team sports, in American team sports, unprecedented levels of endorsement dollars for an African-American team sport player, had the chance to get the highest salary in NBA history twice. Comes back for the Bulls in the late 90s and has a $30 million contract and a $36 million contract, and that was important. And it had been important to him for a while. Magic Johnson, while covering the 93 finals for NBC, would sit around and chat with the media, and he told us, one thing Michael hasn't had is that distinction of being the highest-paid player in the game. And that was something that he'd wanted for a long time, wasn't able to finally get it until 96. And so you saw Michael's desire just to have money at all costs. And it wasn't about the need for the money when it came to, you know, tossing quarters against his security guys for $20, but it was this desire to get your money, to beat you by taking your money.
I had Charles Barkley on yesterday, J.A. Adonde joining us, and I said, listen, as an African-American, you can have an opinion on this, and mine doesn't really count as much. I see it from the outside. I said, I do think we ask so much of our athletes, and so many have to overcome situations in their life that by the time they get to their professional status, I just appreciate them. I'm not going to hold them accountable for great political savvy or great, business acumen. I just appreciate, I can separate, first of all, art from artist. We're all flawed. But I think it's unfair, looking back, that we asked Michael to be an activist or care about something politics, which he had almost no interest in. But that's my perspective. What is your perspective on that?
I've always wished and wanted and hoped that he would do more, but I don't think it's a major detraction. One thing I was thinking, okay, what if he had endorsed Harvey Gantt? Would that have made a difference? Would that have changed enough minds to get him elected? He did support him and make donations to his campaign.
Yes, he did.
So, Do you think that matters more than his endorsement? You know, LeBron James endorsed Hillary Clinton in 2016, and Donald Trump still won in the state of Ohio. So part of it is, what difference would it have made?
Right.
Also, I don't look for our athletes, our entertainers, to provide leadership in that. That's not their area of expertise.
Thank you.
You know, and especially today when we have an African-American former president. I'm interested in his political opinions, and Barack Obama's endorsements. Those carry much more weight to me than what an athlete or entertainer does. And also, what if he'd been outspoken, but we disagreed with him?
That's right.
You know, like, there's no guarantee that people are going to say what you want them to say. So I think what it was that we wanted them to say things. You know, it's funny. Like, I look at Mark Hamill's tweets on social media, and he's very politically outspoken. And I think, like, yeah, this is cool. You know, Luke Skywalker agrees with me. But what difference does it make, ultimately? You know, it maybe makes me feel better. I think it makes people feel better if the people that they look up to hold the same views as them,
yeah,
right? And I think that's what we want.
Yeah.
But all it does is make us feel better. I'm not sure it makes that much of a difference. And I do think you can make a difference behind the scenes. And Michael did do some things behind the scenes. And, yes, he could have done more in front of the cameras and spoken out. You know, maybe he could have spoken out more for people who didn't have the advantages and the luxuries that he did. I'm not sure he did that enough. But I know he did do things to support people who didn't have as much. And, you know, look at to the media guide for the Charlotte Hornets and look at the directory and look at the diversity of the staff that I would say is higher than the typical professional sports front office. And I think you can say he's made a difference in that way.
Yeah, I've told sports writers or no, sports media people in my life, Chuck Todd can barely change my mind politically. A sportscaster can't. So
right.
You're doing this for an attaboy. You know, you're doing this for validation or preening or projecting on social media. You're not going to change anybody's vote, so don't screw your career up. J.A. Adonde is joining us. So I want to shift to Kobe now. Did you ever talk to Michael about young Kobe, and what did he say, J.A.?
I did. I happened to be in D.C. when Kobe was on one of those stretches, scoring 40 points every game. And I asked Michael about it. This is when Michael was playing for the Wizards. And he said, you know, I see in him that same desire to separate himself from his peers that I had. You know, the way that I wanted to separate from Clyde Drexler or Charles Barkley. And he wanted to separate from, I forget who he was being compared to at the time, maybe Allen Iverson, Tracy McGrady, Vince Carter. And he saw that. And, you know, we've come to learn both from Michael at Kobe's memorial and Kobe in this documentary, they were able to interview him before he passed away, talking about the relationship that they had. And they did have this bond. And part of it was just that ultra competitive fury, that drive that they had. I used to see Kobe, one time he was injured the 03-04 season and he had nothing better to do. So before the game, he would challenge and bet, you know, members of the media like Michael Thompson, the former Laker who's on the radio broadcast crew, other reporters around. He tried to engage me. I knew better than to bet against Kobe Bryant. I was not going to bet against Kobe Bryant. So he did stuff like, could he make a half-court shot left-handed? His right shoulder was injured, so he was shooting everything left-handed. And could he make one from half-court if you gave him three tries? And, you know, if he did, you had to do like 50 push-ups or 100 push-ups. You know, they were kind of low stakes. He wasn't going to try to bankrupt you.
Yeah.
He would bet the ball boys in Miami. He'd give them a pair of shoes if they beat him in a shooting contest. if he won, they had to run the steps in the arena. And, of course, he won. And I just remember this grin on his face as the kids running up and down the steps. And Kobe says, isn't competition great? It makes everything better.
Yeah, a lot of similarities.
Those guys had
Mike.
To turn everything into competition.
Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah, sometimes our greatest strengths are our personal frailties, and that's the reality of Michael. Is he was hyper aggressive, and sometimes to the point where it could be mean spirited or overwhelming. You work in a college campus now as the director of sports journalism at Northwestern. You know, when Kobe passed away, your students grew up watching Kobe, but they probably didn't grow up watching MJ. But do you sense The Last Dance, do you sense his influence on your college campus, even for 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds?
Well, it's certainly been there with the Air Jordans. I mean, you walk on campus, kids still born long after Michael's heyday are walking around wearing Air Jordans and really value them. What they're seeing, so Melissa Isaacson, my colleague who covered Michael for the Chicago Tribune in the 90s, she's on our faculty, and her and I do a chat with our graduate sports students, sports journalism students, every Sunday during the airings of The Last Dance, and just to answer any questions they might have, just tell some behind-the-scenes stories of covering Michael and the Bulls. And I think it's fun for them, and they really are just amazed, I think, at how driven he was, how great he was, how big those Bulls teams were, just everything they did mattered, how larger than life they seemed, how outrageous Dennis Rodman was, all of it. I think it's difficult to relate. And I said, I kind of compare it to when people watched the U 30 for 30 on the University of Miami football team and just how wild and outrageous they were. And you just can't fathom a football team acting that way. You just can't fathom the circumstances of this team, in part because they didn't have social media. Like, I think Michael Jordan and the Bulls would have been destroyed by social media and the internet. It's best for everyone involved that those things weren't around back then. But just the way the coverage that existed before social media and the way that this team could exist, and they couldn't be demythologized as easily. If we were seeing them, the people were tweeting stuff that I saw Michael Jordan here doing this. So there was this mythology around them, and that carries to this day.
I could spend an hour talking to you about this. As you know, having been in this business, there are restrictions on time.
Hard out? Is that what you're saying, Tom? We got a hard out?
Well, you do a great job. I'm very, very happy for you. And I just find that your perspective on this is fascinating. I'd like to bring you back, if I could, in about a month when this whole thing's over for another opportunity, because I feel I'm shortchanging myself, you, and the audience here. But congratulations on your career ascension, and I'm very happy that you came on with us today. And keep kicking butt. You're spreading the right messages to those journalism students in a great American city and a University Northwestern. And please come back on again when this thing is over. I'd love to hear more.
Hey, Colin, I'd love to. And it's not like we're going to have anything else to talk about a month from now. So I'd love to visit you. Great to talk to you again, Colin.
Be sure to catch live editions of The Herd weekdays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific.
Joe Burrow is a nice quarterback prospect. He's not nearly as talented as Justin Fields or certainly Trevor Lawrence, the Clemson quarterback. But it's remarkable to me that because Joe Burrow, on a significantly better team, at 23 years old, he'll be 24 soon, beats a 20-year-old Trevor Lawrence with an inferior team, Clemson. LSU was a better team. They had 15 guys drafted, 5 in the first round, or 14 guys drafted this year, 5 in the first round. That's insane. And there's an argument to be made, and I don't have a lot of pushback, that LSU is the best college football team for a season ever. I don't have a lot of pushback. They beat 7, like, top 25 teams or I don't have it in front of me, but it's hard to argue. They beat everybody, and often convincingly. But Mel Kiper was on an ESPN show this morning, Get Up, and he's talking about, well, because of that game, you saw it, Burrow's way better than Trevor Lawrence as a prospect.
How can you see those two on the field in that final game and think Joe Burrow wouldn't have gone number one over Trevor Lawrence, considering Lawrence was struggling in the game prior to that against Ohio State until, like I say, Sean Wade left that football game and that game turned? So I think, no question, Joe Burrow would have been a lock, guaranteed to be the number one pick to the Bengals.
Not a single GM I know thinks that. Not one. Joe Burrow's a fifth-year, 23-year-old senior who didn't do anything, could not beat out JT Barrett. Dwayne Haskins couldn't beat him out. JT Barrett's a scout team guy in the league. Trevor Lawrence was so good that he goes to Clemson. The coaching staff says, Kelly Bryant, you're 12-2 last year. Sit down. 19-year-old's better. He's just 20 now. At 19, he walked into a program that was on fire, that had won a national championship. Here's Kelly Bryant, goes 12-2 the next year. They sat him for a 19-year-old. High school, not close. I saw Trevor Lawrence play in high school. He's bigger than Burrow, stronger, better arm, bigger hands, better athlete, everything. This is totally unfair. As a freshman, Trevor Lawrence, 30 touchdowns, 4 picks. No redshirt year. Just go play. It's not close. to say that Burrow beat Trevor Lawrence head-to-head proves anything, is Nick Foles better than Tom Brady? Because I watched the Super Bowl. What does that prove? Larry Bird's team beat Michael Jordan a lot. So did Isaiah Thomas's team. Doesn't prove anything. Michael was better. So this downgrading Trevor Lawrence because he lost to probably the best college football team ever makes no sense. In fact, there's an article today. Joe Burrow draws concerns from anonymous NFL general manager. He's Alex Smith-like. According to Mike Sando, Mike's really good, The Athletic, the GM compared Burrow to Alex Smith. He said, quote, he doesn't have a lot of power strength in his arm at all. He's a one-year producer. Love his brain, his short accuracy. He's Alex Smith. In fact, Burrow's 6'4", 220. Smith was 6'4", 213. They're even built alike. I've said Burrow's more Tony Romo, but I think Romo and Alex Smith, talent-wise, pretty darn close. I'd take Romo by an inch. So I just think it's incredible that because of a singular game, Trevor Lawrence had never lost a football game till LSU. And people say, well, you know, he struggled against Ohio State. Against Ohio State, Trevor Lawrence threw for 260 yards, two TDs, no picks, rushed for 107 yards and a touchdown, and they won. That's struggling? And that was the best Ohio State team, people said, ever. People were saying that was the best Big Ten team ever. So I think it's incredible how unfair we are to this kid. He's a really nice quarterback prospect. Trevor Lawrence is almost 4 years younger than him. He's a kid. Trevor Lawrence's ceiling, he's not even close to it yet.
Want more Herd? The Herd streams 24 hours a day, 7 days a week within the iHeartRadio app. Search Herd to listen live or on demand whenever you'd like.
So years ago, I've told the story. I worked in Tampa, and I love the NBA, and nobody in the sports office wanted to cover the NBA. And I was like, I'll go cover it, because we had this team in Orlando, which was about an hour drive away, and they had Penny Hardaway, and they had Nick Anderson, and they had Shaquille O'Neal. And they were kind of like, people thought they were the next great team. They were the nicest guys. Penny Hardaway wouldn't remember me. I was this nobody reporter. But I remember going back, and I would tell guys, I'm like, it's the nicest team I ever covered. Like, everybody was, like, gracious and nice. Penny Hardaway was the emerging star. Third year now entering as the Memphis head basketball coach. He made the All-Star team four times in 14 years in the NBA, a gold medal winner, a National High School Player of the Year in 1990. And Penny is now joining us. First of all, thank you and congratulations on getting the job. It's very rare that a star player gets into coaching and succeeds. You have a winning record, so good for you. Congratulations.
Now, first, thanks, Hoff. I really appreciate everything and being on. It's been a great ride for me so far.
So let's start with this. So when you broke into the league, Michael was retired. Then he came back. Do you remember? Because a lot of people, Penny, thought you had a lot of Michael Jordan. A lot, in your game, very vertical, could handle the ball, could drive to the basket, could play above the rim, could shoot a jumper. Do you remember your first meeting with MJ?
Yes, I do. I remember that I was hearing rumblings about him coming back, and the game that he came back, I think it was at Indiana, and I got super excited because I hated that he was retiring when I was coming into the league, and then he came back. I was like, I'm going to get an opportunity to play against who I thought was the greatest player of all time, and to see how I could test my skills against him. And the first game that we played against him, I felt like I had to get my respect in that game. And I think we beat them. I had like 36 points, and we beat them that game at Orlando.
Now, so when he came back that first year, people forget this. Your Magic beat those Chicago Bulls. It's as if that series never happened, Penny. It just disappeared into the ether. But let's go back to that series. So Michael comes back. You actually are the Kings of the East. So talk about that series. And was Michael at his best? Was he still working himself into shape? Take me back to that series.
No, Michael was not at his best. He was not the Michael Jordan that we all knew all those years when he had a rhythm. When he came back, he was rusty, and rightfully so. He changed numbers. He was wearing number 45 because of his baseball number. And then he changed to number 23 in game two and played a better game. But you could just tell he was very rusty. He did not like the new arena. He was the old Chicago Stadium guy. He had never – the United Center was not his type of a building when he first came back. He was having problems shooting the ball off the glass. He didn't like the rims. He didn't like the bigger arena. It was like a lot of things that were like a factor for us, for sure, that were just, you know, he wasn't himself. And we had all those things working against us. I mean, working against them and helping us and working for us, and we beat him in that series.
Now, it's funny. Then the following year, Michael's back to being Michael. He's now not in baseball shape. He's in basketball shape. So when you look at your games against him, when he was back to Michael and you're this fledgling young superstar, what was he like to face? Was he tougher to guard, or was he a better defender? Like, where did he give you the most trouble?
Well, you know, everybody's saying that people are overstating things when it comes to Michael Jordan. But once he was really hurt losing that series to us, and that entire summer we were on his mind because he felt like we were the new up-and-coming guys that he was going to have to beat. He had already gone through,
yep,
you know, the Pistons and, you know, Boston and all these guys, the Lakers. He's gone through these guys to finally get to where he really needs to get to. And then he wins 3 championships and then retires and then comes back. And this young team now is like the big dog on the block. And playing in that series the following year, he came back with a vengeance. Even though we had injuries, he was a totally, totally different player, tougher to guard, and he was so tenacious on defense because – it was more personal.
Michael, that was the hand check era, Penny. People always say Michael was stronger than people on TV thought. Did you sense that?
Yeah, for sure. Strong hands, big hands. And when you can hand check somebody, you definitely could push them in an area where they didn't want to go. And you'd have to fight that off and try to resist it. But, yeah, he was very strong because he started working out and getting bigger and bigger every year.
Yeah. When you watch the documentary The Last Dance, Penny Hardaway, the Memphis head basketball coach entering his third year, are you learning any new things about Michael? Anything new?
I've been playing golf with him since he's been retired. I kind of learned some things about him that are kind of like in The Last Dance, like a lot of the stuff. Like he came out and said a lot of people are going to think he's a because of the last Dance.
Yeah.
He's just so competitive. And he just speaks his mind. And Michael is Michael, has a really good sense of humor, always looking for, you know, a joke or to say something. The thing that really shocked me was the Jerry Krause situation where he and Pippen were really just ragging on Jerry Krause as much as they could. That doesn't usually happen with the players in the GM.
No, I mean, actually, your GM was Pat Williams in Orlando. And he's a very gregarious, likable guy. In fact, you go back to your teams. I mean, you know, it's funny. People forget this. You had the Little Penny commercials, which are the Chris Rock voice. There was a moment, Penny, when you were turning into a superstar in America. And when you watch the Michael Jordan documentary, I'm taken back by how godlike he was. It was a mob. And you were, for a brief time, you were getting foisted into that space, Penny. You were literally the next thing. Were you ever uncomfortable with it? Just this constant hovering mass of people and attention and cameras around you.
You know what? I really enjoyed it. And I can see how Michael, for as long as he did it, how he got to a point where he was like, man, I'm leaving it and I'm not going to miss it. For me, I enjoyed every moment of it. I guess everyone's different. I never looked at it and went, man, I can't go anywhere. Everywhere I go, there's mobs of people. I look at that as love, and I just try to reciprocate that and show love back. But, I mean, I can't speak for Michael, but for me, I enjoyed every minute of it.
You know, it's funny. I remember Shaq, a friend of mine lived near Shaq in Orlando on the Butler chain of lakes, and he'd see him out occasionally in a boat, and he's like, man, that guy is so unique, and everybody loves Shaq. Take my audience back, Penny, to the Shaquille O'Neal. Now, this is pre-Lakers. He's a little skinnier. The first time you played with Shaq, take my audience back to how special he was.
No, Shaq was much smaller than he was with the Lakers. Very agile, mobile, could handle the ball, would start the fast break, and be the first person down. If he had the ball and then without the ball, he was the best rim runner and the fastest guy and the first guy down the floor. He could. I don't know who the fastest guy in the league was at that time. But Shaq wasn't too far behind that guy on the dead sprint. Like, he was very athletic and very mobile. I might be overstating that a little bit, but for a big man, he could really move because he understood who he was, and that's the way he kind of figured his game out early on in his career, is that I had to outrun everybody and be in better shape. And he did a phenomenal job. The total Shaq that no one knew was the smaller Shaq that played with me in Orlando. That type of Shaq. Most of the people started seeing him when he won the championships and got a little bigger and stronger.
For the record, Penny, I think you would have adapted well to the current NBA, which is no hand check, more three-ball shooting. Do you ever look at the current game and think, man, I was just born about 7, 8, 9 years too early, maybe 10 years too early?
You know, I think it'd be fun playing this era because I do think that my game would translate from that era to this era because I was a guard that was dynamic in the transition. There's not as much posting up, but as far as the transition game and shooting threes, I'm sure I would have adapted to it. Back in the day, threes weren't my game. I was more of a mid-range shooter than a post guy.
Yeah.
But I do look at the game nowadays and go, man, if I could have played in this era, it would have been a lot of fun.
You know, I you're the Memphis head coach, and I've been saying before for about a year now, I have nothing against the G League. But if I had a son and I could send him to college for a year and have to go to a college campus, have to play within a system, use it as a platform so he can go to the tournament and people can see him. That's the only reason I know who Zion is, the tournament, and Duke. I have nothing against the G League, but I'd like to see the NBA at least occasionally give a hug to college basketball and not see it as an enemy, the way the NFL really uses college football as its ally. Are you bothered by young players now saying, we're not even going to go to college? High school to a minors league, pro league. Does it bother you at all?
It doesn't bother me that guys want to go G League at all. I think I've been, quoted in the last couple of weeks as saying that I say the G League is needed, but only if a kid 100% to me wants to go to the G League. I feel like you do. I wish the NBA and the NCAA could come together and work it out. But if a kid wants to go to the G League, man, I'm all for that. If they see that avenue as being the best avenue for them, then I support that 100%. I just don't like when the kid is already committed or already signed with the school and is focusing on going to that school and then he keeps getting recruited by the G League. That's what I don't agree with, if that's happening. Because if you see a kid come out of his NLI or out of a commitment, you're thinking that there's still negotiations going on. That's the only thing that I said about the G League. I think it's great for development. I think if a kid wants to go there 100%, then I'm for that kid to go 100%. I just didn't like the part of it where if a kid is already focused on going to college and has signed, then I think that kid should be off limits. That's just my thought process.
If you had a son who's a great basketball player, would you tell him to go to college for a great coach, great program for a year, or go G League?
No, I would go to college. And I think the NCAA made a step in the right direction by allowing kids to make money on their own likeness. But there is nothing like college. I think if you ask the percentage of the guys in the NBA, what's more fun, college or NBA, most of the guys are going to say the college experience because you learn so much. You get a chance to be around students. You don't grow up too soon. You get a chance to kind of develop over the months and then try to kind of take your game on, and then you get drafted. But you get a chance to be a kid. The college fans and the college experience is the best experience I've ever experienced in my life when it's come to basketball, more so than the NBA. The money is great, but the college experience is so special. And you want every kid to kind of, go through that and kind of and be a part of that. But like I said, it's not for everybody. It's going to be a selective few guys that are going to say, I don't want to go to college. I want to go to the G League. And, to me, I support those guys that want to go do that.
So you felt you grew up a little bit in college.
Yes, I spent 3 years in college. I played two, and it was the most fun time I've ever had. It's just to develop my game, to be around teammates, where the game is pure. The college fans are amazing, going from arena to arena, going to different college campuses, and doing. Yes, it was the best time of my life.
Yeah, because I was saying when I watched The Last Dance, one thing I'm really struck with, Penny, is how mature Michael was his first year in the NBA, and a lot of that is Dean Smith. That Michael was really a grown-up. Now, he also had great parents. But I really do think Michael was really ready to be the face of the league his first year in the league. And I'm not sure a lot of these kids they're quite ready yet. Like, James Wiseman's a great player for Memphis. He now moves to the NBA. Is he ready? The money, the fame, the travel, the competition, the nightly you know, activity athletically. Is he ready for it?
I don't know if any 18-year-old, and James is 18 years old, is fully ready for that. They're mature. He's a mature 18-year-old. But you don't know if a kid is really fully ready for that because they don't understand what the world really is going to, you know, hand to them. But I just don't see an 18-year-old coming in and just being the face. I know LeBron did a great job. It took Kobe a while. He kind of went through the, you know, the ups and downs of, you know, playing on different, you know, playing on the team and kind of coming off the bench and being being a guy that worked his way up. But and even with Kevin Garnett and guys of that nature. But I don't know if one guy is ready to do and take on the entire league by himself at 18 years old. I know Zion is trying to do it, but it's tough. It's tougher at that age. Yeah. And like you said, with Michael, with that experience of having Coach Smith and great parents, that all helped him be more mature going to that next year.
Yeah, he was refined and polished and ready to roll. Hey, Penny, basketball coach Penny Hardaway, Memphis, entering his third year, winning record, multiple-time All-Star, a decade and a half NBA career. What a pleasure it is to talk to you today, man. I appreciate it.
No, same here. Thank you so much for having me.